third of the privacy torts I want to talk about is the false light tort. False light is, as it says, being portrayed in a false light, in a manner that is erroneous, that is not true, that is offensive. It's very similar to libel, which we'll talk about in Chapter 4, but there's no defamation, and we'll talk about what that means in just a minute. The information doesn't really have to be defamatory, but it does have to be offensive to a reasonable person, and you're going to see the reasonable person show up a couple of different times here. Some examples. Let's say that the Daily Titan reports erroneously, or maybe even truthfully, that they saw Dr. Fellow and me walking across campus holding hands. All right. Now, that might not be offensive to anyone unless you knew two facts. One is that Dr. Fellow is married, and two is that I am married, and we're not married to each other. I guess that's three facts. So he's married to his lovely wife, I'm married to my lovely husband, and neither of us is married to the other. So that's suggesting, in a sense, that we are somehow engaged in an illicit affair with each other. And that would be portraying us in a false light. Now, if it was reported we were holding hands and we were, of course, that would be truth and that's a defense. But it would depend on how the story was cast. Now, if it was reported that we were holding hands and we were not, of course, then it's a false light issue. The actual legal definition is false portrayal of a person's characteristics, conduct, or beliefs that casts a person in a false light. I'll give you some cases in just a few minutes. This did not go to court, but it's a really good example of how false light is different from libel. Kate Winslet, of course, is famous for being curvy. She's a very curvy girl. She's not, a size 0 or 2. But what happened in this GQ, this British GQ magazine in 2003, was that she was photographed in a spread for it. And they really photoshopped the heck out of her body. The retouching is excessive, she said. I do not look like that, and more importantly, I don't desire to look like that. I actually have a Polaroid the photographer gave me the day of the shoot, and I can tell you they've reduced the size of my legs by about a third. Okay, so really, in a sense, most of us would prefer to be portrayed as thin, and that would be a good thing, right? If we can look thinner, that's good. But for someone who has built a career on feeling, basically saying, I'm a curvy girl and I'm good with that, that could have been portraying her in a false light. Now, of course, she didn't sue. There was no court case. But had she decided to sue, she might have had a false light claim because it's a portrayal of her in a false light that might have caused damage to her career. Okay? Let me give you some cases. Don't know if any of you have ever seen the movie Desperate Hours. Don't. It's terrible. But it was based on a real story of the Hill family. Mr. Hill and his family lived near a prison, and several convicts escaped from the prison nearby and took him and his family hostage. And he was able to, by working with the escapees, he was able to get himself and his family out without any harm. A play was written about that experience, and Time magazine reviewed the play. The play, I believe, was also called Desperate Hours, and then it was made into a movie. And Mr. Hill said, look, they made me look like Superman there. Yes, I did some heroic things, but really I was just a guy looking out for my family. I really was not as heroic as the Time magazine said that the play made me. So it was sort of a double step here. The Time magazine reviewed the play that was made of the Hill's case. And the Supreme Court applied actual malice and said, well, there's no real falsity here. They may have portrayed you in a little bit. They used the actual malice standard, which we'll talk about in Chapter 4. And frankly, we don't see any actual malice. They don't get to win. A little bit easier of a case to understand is the Cantrell case. Mrs. Cantrell had lost her husband, and she was raising a family on her own. Reporters were sent out to do a follow-up story on the anniversary of the husband's passing. But they didn't bother to call ahead, so when they got to Mrs. Cantrell's house, she wasn't actually home. The reporter and the photographer didn't really want to go back out to the Cantrell's home, so they asked her kids, hey, if we asked your mom this question, what would she say? They asked the neighbors, if we asked Mrs. Cantrell this question, what would she say? So they sort of made up quotes for her based on the idea that they had actually spoken to her. The story is published in the newspaper. Mrs. Cantrell reads it. Of course, she had never given any of those quotes, so she was portrayed in a false light. She sued, she won. because the actual malice standard was actually supported. The reporters made up the quotes. One of my all-time favorite cases in media law. There are two kinds of false light. One is distortion, and it's really distorting or omitting facts that a reasonable person might think ill of the distorted person. And my favorite case in all of media law, frankly, or one of my favorite cases, is Linda Duncan. Duncan versus WJLA TV. It's a district court of appeals case, so it's not the Supreme Court case. But it really illustrates false light the best way I can think of. Mrs. Duncan, Linda Duncan, is walking down the street, minding her own business in Washington, D.C., and they get a full-face shot of her. And it gets put into the B-roll file. A B-roll, of course, is like generic footage that is used to illustrate many news stories. So the reporters decide to do a story on a possible new cure for herpes. And as they are saying the line, for the 20 million Americans who have herpes, it's not a cure, they are focused in on a full-face shot of Linda Duncan. What would a reasonable person think? That she had herpes. She didn't have herpes. She sues. She wins. That is false light. A couple years ago, the Daily Titan had a very similar case. They called me up and they said, will you take a look at this? There was a discussion about how condoms were free at the student union, at the health center on campus, and they showed pictures. They were talking about people coming in to get free condoms. They were showing a couple from the back walking together going toward the health center. And you could clearly identify who these people were. And the editor-in-chief turned to me and said, that's Linda Duncan, isn't it? And the answer is yes, because what would a reasonable person assume? The reasonable person would assume that those people were together and going to the health center to get condoms. Okay? So that is a false light claim. Okay? Now, what if Linda Duncan had herpes? What could she have sued for? If you answered private facts, you'd be right. Because it would be an embarrassing private fact that would be nobody else's business. So that's an example of distortion. On the other hand, fictionalization is what you think it is. It's making stuff up. So the Hill case, the Cantrell case, were both fictionalization cases. Okay. A couple of California cases based on that picture there. Picture was taken by famous photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson. Very nice picture of John and Sheila Gill photographed in their ice cream store. The photo was purchased, licensed for use in Harper's Magazine and Ladies Home Journal from Henri Cartier-Bresson. Okay, so he owns the copyright on it. He licenses it. This is not a copyright case. The photo is used to illustrate two different stories. In the Hearst case, which is Harper's Magazine, the story was about love in general. Okay, they said, oh, isn't this a nice picture, and isn't love great, and love is in the air, and the whole thing. And the California Supreme Court said, well, you know, the picture had not been surreptitiously snapped on private grounds, but taken of plaintiffs and opposed, voluntarily assumed in a public marketplace. So not only was it not problematic because it's used to illustrate the idea of love, it was not an intrusion case either. However, the Ladies Home Journal case, which is the Curtis Publishing Company case, the court said, well, the Gills get to win here. Because the story the picture is being used for is saying that these people may have been involved in love at first sight. The idea of we see each other, we have lust for each other, we jump into bed. And the story is not very flattering, so therefore it could be assumed that the Gills might actually be that kind of a couple when in fact there was no evidence that they were. So same picture, two different cases, two different outcomes. Okay. Defenses. Best defense for false light is truth. I'm going to say that again. The best defense for false light is truth. You can't really be cast in a false light if the information that is being published about you is truthful. Okay? Now, there are cases of libel where there have been ideas of libel by defamation by implication, where all the facts that are true are strung together to make sort of a suggestion. Some states have recognized that, but again, that's a libel situation. Generally speaking, if you've got a false light claim, your best defense is to prove that the information is true. If someone consents for you to cast them in a false light, that's not really such a good idea. It's just kind of a setup. But you could maybe argue that, you know, you maybe showed the quotes or showed the story, and the person agreed that that information was true. They can't really come back at you and say it's not. Newsworthiness might also be a defense, but when would it be newsworthy to cast somebody in a false light? I'm not sure I know that. And in some jurisdictions, fair comment and criticism, if people are quoted, that might also be a defense. But frankly, the best defense for false light is truth. Okay, last privacy tort I want to talk about is misappropriation, appropriation, right of publicity. The use of somebody else's name or likeness, their voice, their name, their image, their signature, their something distinguishing about them without their permission, generally speaking for financial gain. Just about anything can have an appropriation issue. Nicknames, pictures, voices, signatures, catchphrases, all of that stuff can theoretically be appropriated. Just about every state recognizes this tort, and many states consider it to be a property tort, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. And it's the most easy to understand. And we're going to find out that the best defense for it is consent. So if you're going to use somebody's name or likeness to sell goods or services or to promote goods or services, you better have their agreement. Okay? Let me give you an example of the difference between appropriation and right of publicity. Some states, including California, recognize two different flavors. Okay? Right of publicity is a commercial issue. It's a property right. All right. So Elvis Presley, for example, who yes indeed is dead and not working at the 7-Eleven or anywhere else, presumably, he still has right of publicity in his name and likeness that is passed on to his estate. It's a right of publicity claim. It's commercial value. Okay. Basically, it's a celebrity tort. Okay. And it's a commercial use issue. On the other hand, appropriation or misappropriation is a personal right. It dies when I die. Let me give you an example. Let's say that a student group on campus likes the idea that I support free speech, and they want to use my name and likeness on their posters saying, if Belmis likes free speech must be a good thing because Belmis is cool. Now, let's say that this organization is a student chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, there is no such organization on campus as far as I know. I'm not even sure that they could be on campus. There's probably some sort of regulation that would forbid them, but let's say that that was the case. Now, I don't want my name and likeness associated with the KKK, even though I agree that in many cases they might be able to speak, right? I mean, I still like freedom of expression even if it's by people I don't like. So I might want to protect their expression, but I certainly don't want my name and likeness associated with them. I could sue for misappropriation. There's no money exchanging hands here, but I still have the right to control my name and likeness and its use. And it's a personal right. And it mightn't cause me embarrassment or shame to be associated with this group. So that would be an example of an appropriation right. Using, you know, Britney Spears' name or likeness without her permission to sell something, that would be a right of publicity claim. Okay? All right, here's some cases. That woman there on the side of the box of flour is named Abigail Roberson. Some photographer back in New York in the early 1900s took that lovely silhouette of her and decided that he was going to sell the picture to this folding box company to use on the side of flour boxes. Abigail goes to the grocery store. She sees her face on the side of the cereal box and says, wait, I didn't agree to let this happen. She sues, and New York says, well, you know, that's not so good, but we don't really have a law to give you any money, so you're kind of out of luck. Wouldn't it be nice, New York, if we did? And the New York legislature says yes. So they passed the first privacy statute later that year, 1902. And the law was very simple. The name, portrait, or picture of any living person cannot be used for advertising purposes without first obtaining that person's written consent. So the earliest right of publicity appropriation cases were basically about money, like Abigail Roberson here. One Supreme Court case in this, that gentleman there is named Hugo Zucchini. Hugo Zucchini made money earlier in his life by being shot out of a cannon. Okay? Some news organization in Cleveland went to the practice runs of the circus, took film of the entire 15 seconds of Hugo Zucchini's act. He climbs into the cannon, the fuse is lit, he gets shot out of the cannon, it's a dress rehearsal, and they show it on the nightly news, even though Hugo Zucchini said, I don't want it shown. Because why would you want to come and see my act at the circus if you could see it for free on TV? And the Supreme Court agreed and basically said, you deprive this guy of money. Neither the public nor the respondent will be deprived of the benefit of petitioner's performance as long as his commercial stake in his act is appropriately recognized. So in other words, if you were going to use it, you know, broadcasting station, you should pay the guy for it. A couple other cases. These boots are made for walking, made famous by Austin Powers movies, was originally recorded by Nancy Sinatra. That song does not owned by her, but it was made famous by her. Goodyear tires had a wide boot tire, and they were using the song, Nancy Sinatra's song, or the song made famous by Nancy Sinatra, even though she didn't own it. Bunch of girls in go-go boots singing, "These boots are made for walking." It's clearly not Nancy Sinatra. It is not her song. She sues for right of publicity because and loses because it is clearly not her, and it is clearly not her song, and it is clear that she is not endorsing the product. However, on the other hand, Johnny Carson wins when a porta potty group wants to use "Here's Johnny" to sell portable toilets. He hadn't agreed. Clearly that is associated with him, created by him, his intellectual property, as well as his right of publicity. He sues, he wins. There are some cases in your book when you read the chapter that talk about Vanna White and her fight with Samsung to retain the control of her property. I'm doing some research with Professor Jerry Wright on this stuff. It's pretty interesting to me. Okay. Best defense for appropriation, really the only defense for appropriation, is consent. If you're going to use somebody else's name or likeness to advertise a good or a service or to make money or to advertise your point of view, you best have their written consent. Okay? Newsworthiness, well, it might be newsworthiness, but I'm not really sure how. Your book talks about fair comment, fair use. Frankly, the best defense for appropriation is consent. Okay. A little bit about online privacy. Let me tell you a little story real quick. My niece, once upon a time when she was a little girl, was into the Spice Girls. Could not get enough of, you know, the Fab Five girls back in the 1990s. And she was going online to get pictures of the Spice Girls to print out on her mom's color computer to, you know, put up in her locker at school. You might not know this, but Jerry Halliwell had another job before she was Ginger Spice in the Spice Girls. And that happened to be posing nude for various men's magazines. My niece was surfing around looking for pictures, and she happened to find Jerry Halliwell without any clothes on. My sister found out about this and said, "What? This is not so good." So she talked to me about this. My niece was also really interested in getting bright, shiny objects without her parents' consent. She didn't realize that if you gave the numbers on a plastic card that was in my sister's purse, and you were shipped, you know, charm bracelets or, you know, mirrors or picture frames in the mail, that actually cost money. Congress has children too, and they're worried about kids going online. They're worried about kids' privacy. And they passed COPPA, the Child Online Privacy Protection Act. Basically, that says that companies cannot collect information about kids without parental consent. Still in action today. The age is under the age of 13. It's an arbitrary age, but there you have it. The FTC is still concerned about online privacy. Okay? They have been recommending a 4-point program that people, when they get their information gathered online, have to be notified about what's getting gathered, be given a choice about whether that information is gathered and saved, be given access to that information to be able to correct it or delete stuff, and be assured of security for that information. So far, there are no other laws passed about this, but Congress continues to toss that stuff around. The European Union, on the other hand, has much stronger rules about data privacy than the United States has. All right? We'll talk about that in a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about privacy issues in social networks. Some of the biggest issues recently in privacy law have been about Facebook and MySpace and about how they handle privacy issues on their websites. Facebook, in fact, is in trouble with a whole bunch of countries all over the globe about not managing its privacy sufficiently. And there was a big flap earlier this year about Facebook's privacy policies and how they went back and forth and back and forth on protecting privacy issues. A couple of cases I'd like you to be aware of. Cynthia Moreno versus the Hanford Sentinel here in California. Cynthia Moreno is from Coalinga, California. She went away to Stanford University and decided she really didn't like Coalinga that much. So she wrote an ode to Coalinga, in which she pretty much bashed the heck out of the city. And she posted it on her non-private MySpace blog. Somebody tipped off the Hanford Sentinel reporters about it. They reprinted her story from the public blog in one of their op-ed pieces. And her family took a lot of heat. They had to close their business. They had one of their windows in their houses was shot. It was not a very good scene. Moreno sues. She says, look, I didn't, you know, provide any of this permission. And the court basically said, well, you know, you're suing for privacy, and you don't really have any privacy if you put your information on a non-private blog. You basically put it out there for everybody to see, and they didn't, you know, you didn't sue under invasion or under intellectual property issues. You sued for invasion of privacy. You don't have any private rights on a non-public or a non-private blog. Okay? In the Pietrello case, some of you actually may work for the Hillstone Restaurant Group. I know a couple of my students in the past have. These restaurant employees made a gripe site where they made a site on Facebook or on MySpace that was private where they went in and complained about their bosses and who they thought was hot at the workplace and the whole thing. And it was by invitation only and password protected. Managers found out that this site was existing, and they threatened one of the employees, saying, if you don't provide us an access to this website where this complaining is going on, we're going to fire you. So they get the password, they go on the website, they see what the complaints were about, and they fire the employees who were complaining on the gripe site. The court gets the opinion, and basically the federal court said, look, this was a private site. It was password protected. The manager should not have been able to get a hold of this password. They did it under, you know, without real authorization from the owners of the site, and they engaged in trespass. Okay? So it's kind of a mixed bag here. Essentially, the courts have been willing to recognize that if you have a really private site that you password protect, that is a reasonable expectation of privacy. So if you've got a MySpace page or a Facebook page and there's not stuff you don't want, if there's stuff on there you don't want employers to see, set your stuff private. Or better yet, take it off. Because some employers have been known to create friends or use friends of friends accounts to see you in your private space. So far, none of those cases have gone all the way to a court, but I still worry. I would not have anything online that I wouldn't want my grandma to see. That includes things like beer bongs or any other unsavory behavior. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the European Union. A number of our students now today are doing business abroad. Certainly if you've got an eBay site even, and you're selling your goods and services on eBay, you might be selling to somebody in the European Union. You need to be aware that the European Union has much stricter standards than the United States for how data about its citizens is gathered and used. Okay? If you go to, where is it here? The Department of Commerce, the U.S. Department of Commerce, they have a safe harbor framework that has been developed with the European Union that can help you manage the personal data of your European customers. Okay, so you should be aware that the European Union has stronger privacy standards and that United States companies are expected to abide by those rules if they are doing business with people who live in the EU. And that is Chapter 5. I look forward to any questions that you have.